Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast, Neue Musik Leben. This is usually a German podcast. It's about the life and the living of new or contemporary music. And once in a while, I do English episodes like today. I'm a singer and I have studied classical singing, but I got very early into singing lots of contemporary and experimental music. I have a website, www.irenekurk.de, and I will put this website for you into the show notes. In this podcast, I talk about themes all around new and contemporary music and the life of it. I share with you the insider knowledge behind the scenes, and I really want to bring you the human beings out of the music world closer to you. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, one of the leading music papers in Germany. In today's podcast, I have an amazing guest for you, Joan LaBarbera. Yeah, she is the singer and she also became a composer. And I mean, she has worked with all of them. John Cage, Morton Feldman, Philip Glass, Steve Reich, and so on and so on. And certainly if you're also interested in contemporary music or singing contemporary music like I do, and I mean, I also have sang quite a lot of basically also John Cage, well, then you will hit and meet Joan LaBarbera. You will find her recordings. And I'm so excited about today's interview with Joan LaBarbera. Enjoy.
Hello, Joan. Hello, Joan LaBarbera. I welcome you today in my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Thank you very much, Irene. I'm delighted to be here.
Yes, you're in New York and I'm in Düsseldorf, Germany. The new technique makes everything possible. And I'm so honored because you're an amazing singer, an amazing artist, a composer. And I mean, you have worked with them all, John Cage, Morton Feldman, Philip Glass, etc. What I would like to know first, and I always ask this my guests, is how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Well, I was trained as a classical singer, and I was, you know, going along the traditional route toward opera. But I heard instrumentalists who were experimenting with their instruments, and I thought, ah, you know, the voice should be able to do more than I am being taught. And so I began to start improvising. I began to work with individual instrumentalists. The first person I worked with was a composer, Garrett List, who was a trombonist also. And so I said, Garrett, just play long tones. And I'm going to try to make a sound that is similar to the sound that you're making. And that was like a process. I would make adjustments. I would listen to the sound that I was making and try to analyze and see how I could get closer to that particular sound. And then, you know, eventually left the idea of imitating instruments and just began to explore the voice for all the wonderful things, the myriad of possibilities that are possible with the human voice. It's such a flexible instrument, obviously, as you know. From those early experiments, I worked with poets and writers. Sometimes I had a group called the New Wilderness Preservation Band, and we improvised soundscapes as poets and writers were reading their works. That was one thing. And I just began improvising with a number of musicians and finding my way that way. And then gradually got into making scores. If I was just writing for myself, I didn't have to do that. I just would take notes in my journals about what kinds of sounds I wanted to put into a piece. But then I thought, well, it would be interesting to let people know how I'm thinking about the sounds. And so one of the earliest scores I did was voice piece, one note, internal resonance investigation, which was an exploration of the many, many different sounds that you can make from a single pitch, just placing it in different resonance areas, in mostly in the face, in the throat. And then moving into reinforced harmonics and into what is now known as multiphonics, a sort of double stop for the voice. So I did that by creating a score that I drew the profile of a human head, and just identified places where I was thinking of putting the sounds, and then went through a series of these different resonance areas. I don't know if you've seen that score, but it is sort of...
I have seen that score, yes.
It's an interesting looking score. And another early score was Circular Song, which was inspired by the circular breathing techniques that horn players use. Impossible for the voice, obviously, because what they're doing is holding air in the cheeks and forcing it through the instrument with the cheek muscles as they're inhaling through the nose. And of course, our vocalizing apparatus is below the mouth. It's in the throat. And so I began to vocalize on the inhale as well as the exhale, and then developed this, I would say it's a process piece where it goes through repeating patterns on inhale and exhale, getting to a center point of the multiphonics, and then sort of going back in the opposite direction with these patterns. So those were two early scores. And then I had the opportunity to work on multi-track recordings, mostly in European radio stations. I was not connected with a university in my early years. And so most of my early recordings that are multi-track were done with European radio stations. An early one was with Radio Bremen. And I did a work called 12 Song that was one of what I refer to as my sound paintings, because I tend to see sound when I'm singing. And so when I create scores or when I make notations for myself, a lot of it is a gesture. And so gestures, graphics are really part of the way I work with sound and score things. So beyond Radio Bremen, then I did some recordings at RIAS in Berlin. In 1979, I had a DAAD, grant to come and live and work in what was then West Berlin. And that was an extraordinary experience, because I had never had so much support, so much
absolute. Great.
Yeah, the kind of anything you wanted to do, they really tried to make it happen. So beyond the recordings for RIAS, I did a festival of text sound works and learned a great deal about, for instance, the Italian futurists and their Parole in Libertà, and then the Swiss and German Dada and various things that we included in this text sound festival. So anyway, that's a long answer to your short question.
Okay, so I mean, you were experimenting with your voice, it sounds like, and obviously you also started writing it out very, very early. So would you have called yourself a composer back then?
I started calling myself a composer, I would say maybe around 1974, when I actually created some works. I had a piece called Hear What I Feel, which is a sensory deprivation piece. I was very influenced by the conceptual artists. And so the idea of taping my eyes shut, sitting in an isolated space separate from the performance space and not touching anything for an hour before this performance, and then being led out into the performance space still with my eyes taped shut. And my assistant had put items in these clear glass dishes, six clear glass dishes, And the only instructions I gave were that the item should not crawl and should not injure me. but other than that, I left the person, you know, choose whatever. And by just then touching the substances in these dishes, what I was hoping was to sort of surprise another new sound out of me. So that was, I have had several other people perform that work. But for me, it was an experiment that I was doing in real time with an audience, using the energy of performance as part of what the piece was all about. So I did this in concert. I did a concert called Voices, the Original Instrument in 1975 at Washington Square Church in New York City. And so here what I feel was the first piece on the concert. I also did the voice piece, One Note Internal Resonance Investigation and Circular Song. And then I did a work for voice with live electronics, which were commercially available and mostly designed for guitar players. So I simply fed the vocal sound through these devices. And I used the devices in a way similar to the way I think about improvising. So I would just turn the dials and react to the sound that was being sent back to me from the speakers. But at that point, yes, I definitely was calling myself a composer.
And why did you call yourself then a composer? Because did you go more public than before? Those early pieces were more experiments for yourself?
Well, I think, yes, they were experiments for myself, but also I realized that I had some ideas that I wanted to put into a more, let's say, formal mm-hmm. setting. Also, some of the composers I was working with were really benefiting from the experiments that I had done. I was working with Steve Reich early on, and he was very interested in my ability to imitate the sounds of instruments. So I worked with him on the development of his work, Drumming, which has just mm-hmm. had its 50-year anniversary, because that began in 1971. And as I was working with him, what he would do would play tape loops, and then he would phase ahead so that the patterns would get into a new interlocking relationship. And I would then sing the resulting patterns that I heard from these new interlocking relationships. And after a while, and Steve was notating what I was doing, and then I thought, oh, wait a minute, I'm actually participating in this composition process. So it was at that point that I really felt that it was necessary to mm-hmm. call myself a composer. I did not formally study as a composer, mm-hmm. But I did work with many, many composers over the years, and it was more a kind of traditional, in a way, apprenticeship, mentorship, where you go back to thinking about early musicians who would work with composers and then develop their own material, which is exactly what I did. Mm-hmm. So worked with, you know, Steve Reich, with Philip Glass, with members of the Sonic Arts Union, Alvin Lussier and David Behrman and Robert Ashley. And then I began to work with John Cage, which was a wonderful relationship. He wrote a number of pieces for me and actually asked me to work on some existing pieces that had not been performed by anyone else. So that was a marvelous relationship. I worked with him for nearly 20 years, worked on a lot of different works.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it sounds like everything went very gradually and naturally from, you know, experimenting to composing to share it with other composers. You already mentioned that you studied classical singing. Did it help you at all? Was it a good base or was it more irritating?
Oh, no, it was not at all irritating. I think it was a very, very good foundation. And so when I would try vocal sounds, I was obviously using a healthy healthy working of the vocal instrument. So I never did anything that I felt would injure the voice, obviously. And of course, when I've done workshops over the years, people have said, well, you know, weren't you worried about damaging your voice? And I said, no, because I had a good, healthy technique to begin with. And as I've taught workshops over the years, and I have worked sometimes with opera singers, particularly on works that were originally written for me, and then moved into, let's say, a wider arena, using more traditional opera voices. And for example, Jacob's Room, which is a work that my husband Morton Subotnick wrote for me, was originally written for voice and string quartet, and then expanded to an opera for solo voice and cello. And then he expanded it again for four opera singers plus keyboard and cello. And so I worked with these opera singers. It was commissioned for the festival in Bregenz, and also it was performed in Berlin. And so I demonstrated my technique, and I said, now you think about the sound that you hear, and with your own technique, make a sound that is similar. It doesn't have to be using my technique. It doesn't have to be extreme, as some of my techniques may sound to the listener, but you can come close to it, which is what they did. And also, I must say, when I was teaching workshops over the years, I one time had a speech pathologist who worked with singers, predominantly opera singers, who had damaged their instruments, had nodes, and had to have them operated on. And she said, the multiphonic sound is actually something that we use because it's a kind of internal massage for the vocal cords. So it's not at all an unhealthy technique. It's actually something that's used to rehabilitate the vocal folds after they've been damaged.
That's amazing. I mean, I'm also a big fan of the vocal fry, and I also know that it's very healthy, but now there is also more knowledge about it, because sometimes when I still sing classical oratorio, sometimes I hear whatever the alto singer on the bathroom also do vocal fry. I'm like, hey, she knows it. Yeah. And so for me, whenever vocal fry shows up in a piece, I'm like, cool, I can relax.
Yes.
And also with the multiphonics, I mean, they only work if you are relaxed. If you're somewhere tight, they don't come out. And like our colleague, Lauren Newton, she also improvises a lot. She also warms herself up with multiphonics because it's, we have to know more about it, and that some sounds are really not scary.
Yeah. I mean, actually, there are some I think musicologists and singers who are exploring the whole use of the vocal fry, and they call it the creaky voice.
Wow. That's great. I have to look into that more, because I'm also such a big fan of it.
Yes. And as you say, it has to be a very, very relaxed use of the instrument.
Yeah. And what I'm also hearing is, I mean, you went into everything through experimenting, and you have the space. And for me, it was the same. I was classical trained, and then the new music came. And also at my time, I had the feeling there was nobody I could go to. So I was just figuring it out by myself. I mean, now people can go to you, or there are even now positions at universities you can actually go, and somebody can show you maybe the fast track to interesting sounds. But I'm also very thankful that I felt it in my body, and I found my way, and that it feels healthy for me. And I feel it's also about awareness, or having, as you say, too, lots of possibilities in my voice. And
that's a wonderful way of going about it. I mean, I had classical teachers, but obviously there was really nobody I could go to for the kind of work that I was doing. So I just had to, I recorded a lot when I was experimenting, so I could go back and listen and just analyze what the sound where I thought the sound was coming from and how to make the sound. It was just a process of trial and error, you know, trying things out and then seeing if I could replicate the sound again.
Mm-hmm. And you already mentioned a few great composers. What I'm also interested to know is, are there certain qualities you appreciate in composers you work with, or also some of the you already named? What were the most interesting or intriguing features, qualities?
Well, but, I mean, I was certainly interested in the work that I was doing with Steve Reich. And then later when I started, just a few years later, when I started working with Philip Glass, although he did not ask for it, I tended to alter the timbre of my voice according to what instruments were being used in Philip's work. So for instance, if a work was mostly with flutes and the dreaded Farfisa organs, I would imitate, not so much imitate, but I would blend with the sounds of the flutes. If the instrumentation was more with saxophones, I would alter the timbre. So I was trying to keep the voice in a similar kind of timbre to the instrumental sounds. As I said, Philip was not necessarily interested in that. And so singers who came along after me did not necessarily do that. They just use their own vocal sound because that was not something he was really interested in. But, and then working with John Cage, of course, that monumental work of Cage's songbooks, which is just so extraordinary and has so many, many different kinds of sounds in it. I had lots of freedom to work because a lot of it was graphic scores. And for instance, Solo for Voice 67 from the songbooks uses just the extremes, the high end and the low end of the voice. So it sounds like a kind of a bird chirping at the top end and maybe, I don't know, some sort of crocodile or something on the lower end. I recently got from the Holland Festival a video of a recording I had done in 1988. Of that work. So it's so lovely to have video recordings of music, you know, in the developmental stage of the work.
On those people you worked with, did you really have the feeling that it was like a cooperation, that you were like eye on eye and developing it together? And not, I mean, sometimes in the old times, maybe more in Germany, there have been composers, they're like the strict rulers, and then you're like, okay, I have to obey. And I now personally also love it that we are more on one level and really get into it together. How did you perceive that?
Yeah, for instance, well, when my last voice teacher, her name was Marion Zakely Freschel, and she said, you must work with living composers because they don't know how to write for the voice. And so that was a kind of directive from her. And so when I was working with Philip, I would say to him, for instance, yes, I can sing those two notes for 20 minutes. And then after that, you have to take me to a different area in my vocal range. Because, you know, otherwise, I said, you've got to understand the vocal instrument. You've got the vocal folds that are holding in a particular position because you're just doing those two pitches. For 20 minutes. So if I'm, you know, up in a higher part of the range, I said, take me to a lower range. This is in the development of music in 12 parts, for example. And so I'd say the next piece, you have to take the voice to a lower range. And I said, you know, think about holding your arm out for 20 minutes. It's going to get fatigued. You have to relax the muscles. The voice is a matter of muscles. Also, for instance, with Alvin Lussier, whom I absolutely adored, and we would talk about oftentimes the scientific principle that he was exploring in any particular work. So the first work that I did with him was Still and Moving Lines of Silence in Families of Hyperbolas. So he would create a kind of sonic geography. So four speakers, four audio speakers, and he would point the audio speakers towards the center of the space, and then play sign tones. And I would move, this was our first rehearsals, I moved into the space, and I got to a point where I felt I was being bombarded equally distantly from all four speakers, which was not necessarily the geographic center, but it was the sound center for me. And then just using my voice, I moved microtonally away from the sign tones. So basically, I was causing the sign tones to move away from me, just using the voice. So we know, of course, that sign tones sound, it a sign wave is waves. And when you interfere with the wave, you get it to beat. And in this particular case, I got it to actually physically move away from me. And so when I got done with that, and I walked back to where we were, where the equipment was set up, and we were rehearsing in the Merce Cunningham studio at West Beth. And he said, okay, what were you doing? And I explained it to him. He said, okay, that's the piece. So yes, it was very, very much a matter of collaboration and cooperation. And I was happy to do this because it was acknowledged that my contribution to the work was to actually bring it alive. Mm-hmm. It came from theoretical ideas to an actual musical experience or sonic experience. And that was what fascinated me most, working with different composers, was what was their dream? What was their idea? What was something that they were fascinated with that I could bring my expertise to and really help that person realize this idea?
Mm-hmm. And it sounds also like that you had confidence and trust in yourself that you were able to offer something and that you were so clear also about your ideas.
Sure. I mean, I had been working on it, you know, for several years, and it was, you know, the statement voice is the original instrument was a kind of manifesto. It was like, okay, this is the original instrument. And we all have voices, and they all sound a little bit different because of the bone structure in our heads. But because I had really explored this vocal instrument, I knew what I knew, and I knew how to do certain kinds of things, and I was interested in learning more, in exploring further. So yes, I did have a lot of confidence in what I was doing.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like when you work with different composers, you jump into, as you said, their ideas. And then you can jump out again. And I also like that a lot about contemporary music, that there are so many different things I can do. But then you also decided to become a composer. So nowadays you just sing your own works, or do you still sing works by other composers, or how did that change?
I predominantly sing my own works, although every once in a while I do sing works by other composers. There's a very early work by Morton Feldman called Only that was written in 1947. And I sang it for the first time for the Holland Festival. And the copyright date on it was, I believe it was 1987, which was not, I don't remember what it was, but it wasn't the true copyright date. And I went back and investigated, and it had been written in 1947, the year I was born. And when Feldman was 21 years old, it's so simple. I don't know if you know the word.
I know the piece. I've sung it. Yeah.
It's so beautiful. And just, I love to like use that either as an encore or as the last work on a concert. So after I've done all of these extended techniques, and then to sing that extraordinarily simple, pure song is the best way of demonstrating that I haven't done any damage to the instrument.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's it's part of that statement.
Mm-hmm. I see. And I mean, since you teach also voice and you know how to learn a piece, are there any like strategies you can give us how to learn a piece well, or how do you approach it?
Sure, I will look for the most difficult part of a piece, and I start there. And so I'll take a section and just work that section until I feel as if it's comfortable in my instrument. Because then when I go back and I sing through the piece, I already know where the most difficult material is. And so when I arrive there, it's not daunting. It's something that's familiar, and that's my approach if I'm working with notated music.
And what else will you teach your students or people who work with you?
Well, I teach them my warm up, certainly, which is physical relaxation exercises for the body, for the neck, for the shoulders, and then I do a lot of humming because you can really focus the vocal sound when you're humming, and you can't, I'll make that statement, you can't do any damage when you're humming because you can't oversing, and your voice won't let you do anything. If you try to sing something that you're not prepared to sing, it just won't cooperate if you're humming. So that's a good sort of way of checking what you're doing. And then I go to the exploring the resonance areas and just getting people to feel the sense, the sensation of placing the voice in particular areas and then really trying to focus on those areas. Sometimes I'll actually use my fingers on my face, on the bones, and try to feel the resonance in those areas. And then I, of course, teach overtone singing.
Oh, cool.
Of course. Of course. Why not?
I always feel that we singers are almost like sports people. So do you do any, I don't know, sports, yoga or anything, or how to, I mean, you're 75, you look healthy and wonderful. So what
Oh,
do you
thank you.
do to stay like that? And
Yes, I am 75. I swim.
cool.
I swim a lot. I'm very fortunate. I have a pool in my backyard. Of course, in the wintertime, then I have to go to a gym, an indoor gym. Although the first year of the pandemic, I left my pool open until the second week in January until
Oh.
one of the pipes froze and burst, and I called the pool guy. I said, "Okay, I give up. Come close the pool." So I have done yoga. I don't do it religiously, but I have done it, and I do incorporate some yoga positions. And I think actually some of the tongue exercises that I do are similar in a way to some of the like the lion tongue of yoga. And some of the breathing techniques I think are also based in yoga. But the exercises that I do, I actually learned from a number of teachers that I worked with, not only my last voice teacher, but also I had a breathing coach who taught me some exercises that were, as I found out later, based in yoga. I had a coach who was dealing with roles and things like that. So I put together the techniques from a number of different teachers over the years.
And then I also read that you have been writing about the music in New York, and that you shared it like that. And for me, that was also interesting because, I'm doing this podcast, and in a way, I also share about my work. And so I really found that interesting. And I heard you in this talk with Ryan Dohoney that, I mean, sometimes people call you a critic, but you said, no, I was not a critic. I was just sharing what was going on. But how did you get to that, and how did it feel, the writing?
Well, I got to it because many of my friends were composers, and a number of them didn't like writing program notes. And so the audience was bewildered and the music critics were bewildered. And so I decided to talk to my friends, each individually, whoever was about to do a concert. And so I began to do preview articles in the Soho Weekly News, which was a paper that was actually given out free on the doorsteps of Soho in the early 70s. And so I would, we published these preview articles in the paper, and then the audience could read about what the composer had in mind and get some clue or idea as to what they were thinking about. And ultimately, some critics began quoting my previews in their reviews. For instance, John Rockwell, who wrote for a long time with in the New York Times, began quoting my previews, and because he felt that it was a way of his understanding what was going on. So that was the impetus for doing it. And ultimately, Tom Johnson, who was writing for the Village Voice and then also writing for Musical America, and John Rockwell, recommended me to Musical America, and I began writing for what was a magazine, a monthly publication. And when I left New York and went to Los Angeles, I started writing for the LA Times. I had a meeting with Martin Bernheimer, and he said, well, you know, we want to make sure that you don't have any conflict of interest here. He said, I would rather have somebody who knew nothing about music but didn't have a conflict of interest. And I said, you actually have no problem with me. I said, I will not write about anything if I feel that there's any kind of a conflict. So but I more or less wanted to explain to people or to tell people what had happened at the concert, how it came to my ears and my sensibility and my intellect, and to offer, because many times these concerts took place only in New York. And I thought, well, I can give people an opportunity to at least think about what I experienced. And it was a way of getting that information out to a larger audience, which was also why I started doing recordings, because I was predominantly working in New York in the early years. And there used to be this wonderful thing called New Music Distribution Service that was started by Carla Bley, the wonderful composer and pianist, and her husband, Mike Mantler. And it went on for a number of years, and many composers produced their own LPs in the early years, and New Music Distribution Service was a way of getting it out to the world.
Mm-hmm. And so the writing come then easy for you, or what meaning does it have in your whole portfolio of all the things you do?
I wrote for a long time. I wrote poetry, I wrote stories. And when I went to college, I went to Syracuse University initially, and I was dually enrolled in music, the music school, and in the liberal arts school in creative writing. And I had actually, we have these advanced placement tests. So I got credit for freshman English without ever having to take it, because I passed out of the tests. And so my freshman year at Syracuse, I was in a graduate English course. And I did work on Virginia Woolf. My paper was on color symbolism in Orlando, I remember. So I was taking poetry courses, and I had not made up my mind that first year. And then ultimately moved more in the direction of music. But writing has always been something that was part of my being, I guess, let's put it that way. And it's all
great.
It's part of my composition process. When I start a new piece, if I have a title or a thought, or if I'm working inspired by a painting, I'll do stream of consciousness writing, and just I try not to censor. I try not to say, "Oh, that's silly." Mm-hmm. I try to just write everything that comes out of my mind, and when I'm finished, then I go back and I read what I've written, and to see where the music is, where do the words lead me. So mm-hmm. Yeah, words are part of my process.
Amazing. Yeah, now we heard so many things about you, and what I also always like to know is, what is your approach to time management, or how do you handle all those different things throughout the day, and can we learn something from you?
I am a terrible time manager. I am just awful. I am not as disciplined as I would wish to be. And I can always find something else to do. Water the plants, walk the dog, cook. But I do ultimately get down to business and get the work done. But I am not a good role model for time management. I will mm-hmm. admit that.
Okay. But then once you're in it, then you're really focused.
Once I'm in it, I'm definitely in it. And, I love recording. I love the process of recording. I love being in the recording studio, working with engineers who are really good, and know a whole lot more about it than I do. I've done a lot of recording of my own using Pro Tools. So the whole digital domain mm-hmm. that we're in now is certainly a lot easier to work in than magnetic tape.
mm-hmm. Yes, certainly. Yeah. What are you thankful for today?
What am I thankful for today? This absolute day? I'm thankful for the sunshine. I'm thankful for the beautiful trees that I see outside my window that I actually am using as inspiration for a vocal piece. I've been commissioned by Roomful of Teeth, which is a vocal ensemble, to write a piece. And I've been watching the trees and how the breeze or the wind activates the movement or the motion of the leaves. And that's what I'm using as my inspiration right now for this particular piece. I'm thankful for my beautiful dog. I have a wonderful Samoyed. I'm thankful for my son, who is remarkable. I'm thankful for my husband and all my family. I guess I'm thankful. Well, I'm certainly thankful that we're getting to the other side of this dreadful COVID thing, and we're beginning to be able to come out and share our work with people again, and go and enjoy concerts and museums and just being out and socializing again. That's so important.
Mm. And when you look back, what does success mean for you?
I guess being appreciated, having my work recognized, and that it inspires other people. So that's success for me. Being able to share my work, you know, it's so interesting. The vocal instrument changes as the body changes. We talked about the fact that I'm 75. I cannot sing some of the repertoire that I used to sing because the instrument changes. And so while I used to be a lyric soprano, I'd say my range is more contralto at this point, which has nothing to do with extended vocal techniques. It just has to do with the aging of the body. And so I've had to let go some pieces that were part of my repertoire, like the beautiful Three Voices, which was written for me by Morton Feldman. I did it for 25 years. And finally, I had to say no. I can't do it justice anymore. And now there are a lot of people that do that work. Thankfully. So I'm very grateful that I caused it to come into being in the world. And I'm also very happy that so many other singers have taken it on and given it, you know, a life beyond my singing of it.
But isn't it also exciting when the voice, I mean, you have to let go, but when you now have a much lower and deeper range, I mean, there is so much to discover again. And
absolutely, yes, yes. And I'm discovering it every day.
Because I always thought, which also has changed quite a bit when you look at the opera world, I know that I think it was like in the 60s, 70s, when like a soprano would start at an opera house, sometimes they would really start with the tiniest roles and whatever be a soubrette.
Yes.
And then if they really were nurtured nicely, then they became lyric or even more dramatic. And I always thought this is such a great development, because then you can go through different roles and you're not just stuck at one thing. But now I have the feeling they always want to have the people ready, so there's not so much the space to really develop. But I find it exciting if maybe in 30 years I can sing an octave lower.
I'm sure you will. Well, as I said, my last voice teacher predicted that I would become a spinto.
Why?
And so she heard something in my voice that she felt was going to develop into a darker quality. Mm-hmm. From that lighter lyric sound. So the body changes, the voice changes, we keep learning all the time.
certainly. Is there anything that drives you forward, or do you still have a vision, or is there something you want to get done?
Well, I'm really interested in writing for voices, certainly, but also writing for voices and instruments. And I like using electronic. I like modifying sounds with electronics. I enjoy creative works that have a sonic element. I like to call it a sonic atmosphere. We now in the publishing world refer to it as fixed media. Which I think is just a sort of such a dry term, but it allows for a wider range of things. So what used to be the tape part is now referred to as fixed media. I'm exploring all the time. I'm influenced a lot by visual art. I see sound, but I also, when I see a work of visual art, I tend to imagine the sound that that I might make if I were to do a work inspired by that particular piece.
And you said that you also like to write for voice. So when you know who you write for, do you like more to write specifically for a person whose voice you have heard, or do you rather just write and whoever sings it, that just turns out to be?
I'm happier with the result if I write for someone whose voice I know. And writing right now for Roomful of Teeth, I've heard, you know, some of their recordings. They demonstrated a number of techniques. You know, they've studied with a number of singers from various cultures. I'm not so much interested in that. I'm more interested in the quality of each individual voice. And when they perform, they perform in a kind of arc of the eight voices on stage in fixed positions with microphones. And so I'm looking at, in this particular case, dealing with what I refer to as the stereo horizon. So how sound can travel through this group of voices, the way I mix when I'm recording on tape or in a DAW. digital audio workstation. So I'm looking at them as producing sound, and those sounds come from a specific place. And so I can work with the movement of the sounds and also the vocal quality of each of those individual singers.
Great. Well, I think I could talk to you forever because it's so inspiring, but we're actually arrived at the last questions. And there I always ask, what advice or tip would you like to give young artists?
Believe in yourself. Trust yourself. Try not to be afraid of what people will think. And that particular advice comes directly from my mentor, John Cage, who said to me when I was starting out, he said, don't worry if the audience laughs. They're not used to hearing these sounds. Just keep doing what you're doing. And so that's the best advice that I can possibly give. Just do what you love and focus on it and just keep going. And the world will open up to you.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for being here with me, spending the time with me. I wish you all the best for all your projects, compositions, and hopefully we see each other again at some time, at some point.
I hope so. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.